Hi everyone, this is Ronnie Allen, and I am so pleased to be interviewing one of my all-time favorite singers from the 50s and 60s, the fabulous vocalist, Miss Kathy Linden.
Ronnie, I really appreciate that, but this is the show that I interview you.
Uh-oh. You're right, Kathy. Yeah, we did do that other show, so this will be a new experience for me because nobody has ever done an interview show with me. And I thank you, Kathy, so very much for being the only person in the world whom I have ever interviewed who suggested that we turn the tables.
Are you ready?
Ready as I'll ever be, and I wonder how this is going to be.
You'll be surprised.
Well, I've heard that line before somewhere. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, Wait a minute. I'm doing your part here. Start with ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Kathy Linden, and before I introduce you to my very special guest, I'd like you to hear a little bit of his very special piano playing. From a record called Flip Over You from 1961, written and sung and played by our special guest. Recently has sold for $100 on eBay. He has worked as a computer professional for close to 35 years. He worked for Casey Kasem for 15 years for American Top 40, the most popular radio show in the world. He interviewed more than 1,000 people in the record business. He also appeared as a contestant on Wheel of Fortune, and he's also worked as a DJ for more than 20 years. It is my pleasure to introduce Ronnie Allen.
Thank you so very much, Kathy. I am overwhelmed.
You're a Jersey boy.
I was, actually, until 1975, which is a good part of my life. I was born in Jersey City, New Jersey. But I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey. Yep, a Jersey boy. In 1975, I moved to Pennsylvania, where I have been living for more than 40 years, which is amazing because, as you know, Kathy, I'm only 39.
Right.
Yeah, right. Okay.
You once did something that made your piano teacher really mad.
I sure did. Now, you were a piano teacher.
Yes, I was.
Tell me if this would have made you mad, what I did. I did not like the fact that at a recital, I would have to play music from memory. The song that I was going to play was Mendelssohn's Spring Song, and I was very, very nervous. And you're not supposed to, at a recital, introduce the song. But I sat down at the piano, and my fingers were probably shaking all over the place, and I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I am now going to play Mendelssohn's Spring Song. I hope." And when I said, "I hope," everybody laughed. There was a little bit of applause.
Oh,
but the one person who wasn't laughing was my piano teacher.
Teacher, right.
She gave me a pretty good lecture after that. Well, how do you feel about it? Would you compliment me for being original, or would you tell me I really shouldn't have done that, Kathy?
I'm not going to touch that one.
Okay.
No, I don't think I better.
You're being very diplomatic.
Yeah. When did you start listening to pop music, Ronnie?
That was around 1955. I used to listen to a disc jockey by the name of Martin Block. And every Saturday morning, he had a show called the Make Believe Ballroom. He had that show 6 days a week. But on Saturday, what he did was he would do a countdown of the top 35 recordings on the national chart. And I started getting involved in countdowns. I just absolutely loved writing down the numbers, up one button, down one button. And I listened to Martin Block for many years. And I guess I might mention that when we got into the year 1958, you had a record on the countdown, which was Billy. And that was one of my favorites, by the way. And I'm not just saying that. You know that it is and always has been one of my favorites. I want to mention a couple of other DJs that I started listening to. There was a guy by the name of Peter Tripp on WMGM in New York City. He was the curly-headed kid in the third row. He also did a countdown. But his countdown, unlike Martin Block's, which was a national countdown, Peter Tripp did a local countdown, the top 40 records called Your Hits of the Week, top 40 records in New York City. Also, Murray the K, and his show featured a few girls named the Delicates, and little did I know that years later, I would get to know the Delicates very well, but we'll get to that a little bit later.
So in 1957, Ronnie, you started doing something every day after school. What was that?
Well, the first thing I did was I walked home.
Right, I hope so.
I got home, and I would turn on the TV and watch this show called American Bandstand.
Right.
And, in fact, you eventually were on American Bandstand, I know. Most of the acts that were on American Bandstand lip-synced, which means that as the record is playing, you sing along with it, but people are not actually hearing your singing. They're hearing the record playing, and you're just moving your lips. But there was an act on American Bandstand that really kind of changed my life. He was a piano player named Jerry Lee Lewis. He became my idol. He's the man that did a whole lot of Shaking Going On and Great Balls of Fire and Breathless. Fabulous recording artist. And here's the thing. When Jerry Lee was on American Bandstand, he did not lip sync. He actually performed live. And back then, he may have been the only guest on American Bandstand and also Dick Clark's Saturday Night Beechnut Show who did that. Everybody else lip synced. And he became my idol. When I wasn't practicing my scales and sight reading and playing what I thought was dull classical music, I taught myself how to play piano by ear. And most of what I played was the popular music hits of the day, including my favorites by Jerry Lee Lewis.
During the summer of 1958, you worked with Ted Mack, who was best known as the host of TV's very popular show, The Original Amateur Hour. Wow.
Well, I was never actually on that show, but I attended Ted Mack's camp. I was a camper, and I was also a piano accompanist. They did productions of shows because most of the people that went to Ted Mack camp were musically inclined. And I remember something very, very special about my summer of 1958 with Ted Mack because they did a production of Guys and Dolls, which was a huge hit on Broadway and a huge hit as a motion picture, and I was the piano accompanist, and that particular show, Frank Lesser, who wrote all the songs from that show, words and music, attended the production, and I was playing the piano. And the reason he attended is because his daughter, whose name was Sue Lesser, these days she's Susan Lesser, she was a camper at Ted Mack's camp, so I got to meet Frank Lesser. One of the biggest thrills of my life, he came up to me and he said to me, I just want you to know, you did a fabulous job playing my music. I'll never forget him saying that. Kathy, that was just so special.
Wow, Ronnie. Ronnie, I understand that you surprised Ted Mack. How did that happen?
Oh, yes, I did indeed surprise Ted Mack. And this was my father's idea. Every few days, Ted used to take me and a few other musical folks who attended his camp to local Rotary, Kiwanis, and Lions clubs in the area to entertain people at those organizations. And he would introduce me as a gifted piano player, and I would go out and play my very serious rendition of Autumn Leaves in the style of the great and extremely popular piano player Roger Williams. Now, in fact, Roger's recording of that song had been a number one hit 3 years earlier, so people were familiar with it. And that's exactly what Ted Mack instructed and expected me to play. Nothing less and nothing more. Well, there was going to be a big evening show held at a school in the area in which not only Ted Mack and his entourage, but also others in the area would be participating. And it was going to be attended by a few hundred people, so this was a biggie. Now, unbeknownst to Ted or anybody else, I had taught myself to play piano and sing in the style of my idol, Jerry Lee Lewis. Came to the part of the show where it was my turn to do my one number, which was supposed to be Autumn Leaves. Ted introduced me as usual. I got some polite applause, and I started to play. About 15 seconds into my performance of Autumn Leaves, I abruptly stopped. I paused for a few seconds, and then went into bump, 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 bump. You shake my nerves and you rattle my brains. and I did my rendition of Jerry Lee Lewis doing his mega hit, Great Balls of Fire. Halfway through the number, I even knocked over the piano seat, intentionally, of course. And toward the end of the number, I could see Ted Mack on the stage out of the corner of my eye. I couldn't tell if he approved or disapproved. But when I finished, I got a standing ovation from the audience and shouts of, "More! More! More!" Well, happily, Ted was smiling. In fact, he borrowed a saxophone from somebody and said, "One more time!" And I knew I was okay. I did a reprise, and Ted was playing the sax while I was playing the piano and singing. And it was then that I realized, Kathy, that my goal in life was to be a rock and roll star.
In 1961, you got a recording deal and made a record called Flip Over You, which over the years has become well known to collectors. It recently sold for over $100 on eBay.
That amazes me. But it is true. My father arranged the deal. He knew a songwriter by the name of Mo Jaffe. Mo Jaffe had written a few classic hits. One of them was Collegiate, which was in the Marx Brothers movie, one of their movies. I think it was Animal Crackers. He also wrote Bell Bottom Trousers, and he wrote a few other hit songs. And he was a friend of my father, and I had this song, Flip Over You, which I wrote, and I made a demo of that song, on which I played the piano and sang. My father's songwriter friend, Mo Jaffe, knew a record company called Dapt Records. D-A-P-T, and I got to record 5 songs at this particular session, and the drummer on my session was a gentleman named Gary Chester, and I felt really, really good, because Gary Chester was the same drummer that did the ch on Benny King, Stand By Me, da-da-dum, ch-dum, da-da-dum, ch-dum. He was a very famous drummer. Eventually, he did the drumming on other hits like It's My Party, and there were also 2 other musicians. I played the piano and sang, and I recorded 5 songs at the session, including this one, which I hoped would be my breakthrough hit.
Here's Ronnie Allen and Flip Over You.
You were mine and my life was a full of joy, until I saw you out with another boy. And I was sore, so I said goodbye, my tears falling quit went through. But baby, I still flip over you even now. When I said that the time had come for us to part, I was putting my foolish pride before my heart. How wrong I was when I said goodbye, my dear, I'll find somebody new. Cause baby, I still flip over you. And how? Don't you know I'm lonely, lonely, sad and blue. My life is kinda empty without you. Return and give me the love I'm longing for. Baby, I'll be yonder evermore. Come back to me and say that you give me another chance. For I know that all you feel fond romance. And then my life will be so happy, there'll be no one but you. And I will always flip over you, man, like wow.
Sold about 6 copies. My mother bought a copy. And sadly, I was the victim of a major screw-up. I told all of my friends at my graduating class, I said, "Hey, my record's coming out in a week. Please all go to the record shop and buy it." Unfortunately, the record company made a big, big mistake. Instead of putting the correct title, Flip Over You, on the label, they put Flip You Over on the label. Could you imagine how humiliating that was to me, Kathy?
Oh, my.
I called up the record company and said there's been a horrible mistake, and they said, don't worry about it, we'll have the records repressed. But in the meantime, people went to the record store to buy my record, and it wasn't there because of the delay, and then a lot of them went on summer vacation, so it cut down on the number of sales, but eventually they got it right. My record company assured me that none of the copies of Flip You Over would ever surface, ever. They were destroying all those copies. Well, guess what? There are still copies that pop up of Flip You Over on eBay. So they didn't do a great job of destroying them. Anyway, after Flip Over You came out with the correct title on the label, I did some promotion. I did a record hop for Murray the K in New York City, in which I lip-synced the song. There was no piano, so I just stood up and did a lot of singing and wiggling, and during the recorded piano break, some impromptu choreography. The people in the audience seemed to enjoy what I was doing, and they were laughing quite a bit. But to this day, I don't know if they were laughing with me or at me, because my choreography looked silly. I went to Boston and performed at a show hosted by well-known DJ Arnie Ginsberg. Now, they had a piano there, but they wouldn't let me do a live performance. I had a lip sync and piano sync, and since I could barely hear the record while I was performing, it was somewhat of a fiasco. I got a sitting ovation. That is, some polite applause. I did do one live TV appearance on behalf of the record. It was in Providence, Rhode Island, on a show called Dave Sennett's Dance Party, which was similar to American Bandstand. I must tell you, Kathy, I was a big hit on that show. The girls loved me, or at least they did a good job of pretending. I lip-synced Flip Over You in the same way I had done it for Murray the K, standing up and singing and dancing. After my performance, I got a big round of applause, and then I did a brief interview with host Dave Sennett, and then signed autographs. I felt so good. That is, until right after the show, when I noticed that my wallet was missing. Needless to say, my great day was ruined.
Oh, no. What did you do?
Without asking permission, I snuck into an empty office, picked up the phone, called my parents, and told them I was stranded, and they would have to wire me money. Thankfully, they did. By the way, my wallet did turn up a few days later after I had returned home. It somehow had fallen out of my pocket in the car on the way to the TV show. And the other bit of good news is that I never received a bill for that unauthorized telephone call that I made. Of course, that may change now that they're finding out about it. That was one of the five songs that I recorded at the session, and we just heard it in its entirety. As for the other four, we'll hear excerpts.
Tell me about Ronnie Swanee.
Ronnie Swanee was the flip side of Flip Over You, my only released single, and it was my rendition of Swanee River. I tried to do a little bit of it in the style of Buddy Holly. Like Flip Over You, You Fooled Me was an original song, and it was a ballad. I love the record One Night by Elvis Presley, so I figured I would do this one in the style of Elvis.
You fooled me when you said when I thought I knew the score. You loved him more, you just said goodbye, and then you ran away. Oh yes, I cried. How many tears I do not know. I almost died, longing for you, because I love you so.
You fooled me.
But before you break the heart of someone else, just remember this. You're only fooling yourself.
You did a song called Gypsy in My Soul.
Yeah, Gypsy in My Soul is a classic song written by Mo Jaffe, who got me the record deal. I did it really for him, and I was trying to do this one in the style of Carl Mann, who had a hit record with his rockabilly version of Mona Lisa. So this is Rockabilly Ronnie. I didn't realize at the time that was a hit from the 20s. Many people did hit recordings of that. I didn't know the song was 40 years old when I did it, which is, of course, nothing, because when you did Billy, that one was close to 50 years old. And using some poetic license, I changed a few of the lyrics, including incorporating the name of a girl who I was dating at the time. And I did this in the style of Freddie Cannon. Flip Over You and Ronnie Swanee, as I mentioned a few moments ago, was the only thing that I ever released as a single for the public to hear. As for why it was valuable, I didn't know, Kathy, but there was another Ronnie Allen by the name of Ronnie. Oh, gosh. Let's do this line again. I didn't realize that there was another Ronnie Allen.
Oh,
and yeah, I didn't know, Kathy, that there was another Ronnie Allen. I didn't know there was another Ronnie Allen by the name of Ronnie Allen who was releasing records at the same time that I was releasing records. And, his name was Ronnie Allen, and he released a record on a different label called Sand Records called Juvenile Delinquent. And here's a little bit of that one. He did a great job, that other guy who is using my name. This other guy, even though he never had a big national hit, he became very well known as a rockabilly singer, and around the world, his records are in much demand for collectors. Because our names are the same, people confuse him with me. And as a result of a lot of the record collectors thinking that this other Ronnie Allen and me are the same person, Flip Over You is valuable. And as you mentioned, it actually sold for $100 on eBay. And I couldn't believe it when I saw it. I was told a few years ago that this other Ronnie Allen, sadly, had passed away. Then I found out that there was a disc jockey in Tennessee by the name of Ronnie Allen. So I wrote to him and I said, "Hi, Ronnie. My name is Ronnie Allen. I'm a recording artist and I recorded something called Flip Over You. You know, you're the third Ronnie Allen that I know because this other Ronnie Allen recorded Juvenile Delinquent. Sadly, he passed away." And I got an email reply from this Tennessee DJ, Ronnie Allen. And it said, "I'm the Ronnie Allen you thought was dead.
Oh.
I'm that other Ronnie Allen who did Juvenile Delinquent."
What an amazing story.
So here I am telling this guy about the late Ronnie Allen, finding out that he was, in fact, the late Ronnie Allen, who also happened to subsequently become a disc jockey as Ronnie Allen. Well, I immediately sprung into action. I said, "Ronnie, if it's okay with you, I want to interview you." And it was okay with him. So, I did.
Hello, everybody. I'm Ronnie Allen, and I'm pleased to introduce my guest of the evening, Ronnie Allen.
Hey, how are you, Ronnie Allen?
Am I talking to myself? I don't think so. Wait a minute. This is a different Ronnie Allen. You're a Ronnie Allen that lives in Tennessee?
I'm a Ronnie Allen that's a disc jockey in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, and I've been there a pretty good while, yeah, and recorded back years ago for Sand Records.
Wait a minute, you're a disc jockey and you recorded records, and I'm a disc jockey and I recorded records. Are you sure that you're not me?
I play a lot of your stuff, Flip Over You, I like that one.
I appreciate that.
Ronnie Allen is a very common name. I have a feeling there's more Ronnie Allens than there are Kathy Lindens. But there are other Kathy Lindens, too.
There are. There's an artist.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know until I looked on. I think it was YouTube. I'm not sure. There are others.
I was hoping to be able to get ronnieallen.com, you know, for possibly a website that I might do for myself. Unfortunately, when I entered ronnieallen.com to see if it was available, it wasn't. There's a third Ronnie Allen who is a Kenny Rogers impersonator.
Oh, my, really?
And he looks identical to Kenny. He has the domain, and that's him, Ronnie Allen.
Did you attend college?
Yes, I did, Kathy. I attended New York University, a.k.a. NYU, from 1961 through 1965. And I graduated in that year, receiving my Bachelor of Arts degree. My major was Communication Arts, which they sometimes called Television, Motion Pictures, and Radio. I attended the campus at Washington Square in Greenwich Village, the home of the legendary Arch. I even touched the Arch a few times. I must tell you, Kathy, most of my college career is a big blur. I did not live on campus. Instead, I commuted to and from my home in Teaneck, New Jersey, via bus and subway. That was a fairly long commute, about an hour and a half, as I recall, and that at times did contribute to a certain amount of fatigue. I do remember one college incident very clearly. As part of my curriculum, I took some Spanish courses, and on one day in this particular class, I was in the second row and was exhausted. Well, I dozed off. That's a no-no. All of a sudden, I was awakened by something painful hitting my cheek. The professor had taken a small piece of chalk and thrown it at me, and let me tell you, it landed pretty good. I should have been awarded first base. I said nothing, and he said nothing, but he had made his point. What I learned from this is that if you're going to doze off in a college class, make sure you're in the back row where the professor cannot see you or reach you. And that was definitely part of my college education.
In the summer of 1963, you got a job doing something you had always dreamed of doing, but it didn't work out too well. What was that, Ronnie?
I wanted, more than anything else in the world back then, after my recording career failed, unfortunately, Flip Over You, Flip was a flop.
The DAP record label, which was a small label,
became much smaller after I started recording for them. I wrote to 200 radio stations. I went to the library, got the addresses, seeking a summer job as a disc jockey. Well, the response was incredible. I received exactly one reply from the general manager of a small station who was willing to audition me. And he said that sending a tape was not adequate. It had to be an in-person audition. Because of what I'm about to tell you, Kathy, I've decided not to mention the name of the station or the location. The station was only 338 miles from my house, a 5.5-hour trip, but I didn't care. Now keep in mind, I had no experience at all and went there with my parents, and I had my audition with the general manager. The guy says to me, "Well, you know, you need work, but you should be adequate. We'll hire you for the summer." And I went there, and Kathy, my dream job turned into being a nightmare, because this boss was very, well, I don't want to say the T word, tyrannical. So instead, I'll just say that he was very difficult to work for.
Oh.
This was a small farm community. It turns out that there were two very popular DJs at the station, and each of them were taking the summer of 1963 off. So during that summer, every day, Monday through Friday, I would be doing their shifts, trying to fill their shoes. In the afternoon from 1 to 6, I would host an easy listening, or you could call it adult contemporary, if you will, show. And then between 6 and 7, I would grab dinner at a local deli. Then from 7 to 11, I would host a Top 40 show featuring the biggest hits of the day. The station also carried New York Yankee baseball games. And when there was a game, I would be preempted, but would have to sit there in total boredom and run the board. But the boss, a.k.a. general manager, told me some ground rules. I'll never forget the first one. Never play two records in a row by female artists. Or the second one. Never play more than two records by the same artist during any show. And some of the others were, don't talk too much, don't talk too fast, don't ever play two records in a row. You must say something after each record, even if it's just the name of the station. Read the commercials exactly as written, word for word. Identify the station at least 8 times an hour.
Wow.
He also told me, assume that I am listening to the station all the time, because I probably am. And for my easy listening show, the station had a limited record collection, but the boss told me that I could not just play anything in their collection. He provided me with a list of acceptable artists, telling me that I could only play an artist if he or she was on the list. Finally, there was no engineer, so I had to play the records myself. Well, to say I was nervous is an understatement. I tried not to show it, but believe me, I was petrified. During the first week of doing this, I made lots of mistakes. And I got many phone calls from regular listeners who asked when the other DJs would be back. Most of the phone calls were not complimentary. It did not help that I had a Jersey accent. It was obvious that I was not from that area. Several callers said, "Where did you come from?" Others said worse things. What made it even more unnerving, Kathy, was that the boss would often pop into the studio while I was on the air to tell me about what he perceived to be a problem. "You're talking too much. You read this commercial wrong. You played an artist that is not on the list." Occasionally he would come in and criticize me while I was reading something on the air. My listeners could hear him. I would make him aware of the situation. Then he would be quiet, but not for long. This is what I hoped would be my dream job, but it was anything but. I was a nervous wreck. For the most part, it was not fun. A couple of weeks after I was there, the boss told me that my performance was not up to par and that he would be interviewing others. Not exactly a vote of confidence.
Tell me about how you almost got a ticket during one of your air shifts.
Well, it was on a day that the boss was away and there was nobody in the building except me. And it was during an afternoon New York Yankee baseball game. while I was supposed to be manning the control board, I decided that, well, I can hop out of the station for just a couple of minutes, hop across the street and pick up my mail. And when I did that, I had my transistor radio with me. Unfortunately, the game ended very suddenly. And I said, oh no, I'm going to be in trouble now. I better get back to the radio station quickly. And I darted across the street, and then I'm grabbed by a cop. And he says, excuse me, sir, you're jaywalking. And I had to get back to that station. Otherwise, there would be dead air. I said, please let me go. So I can't. I'm in trouble. I have this job. I'm not supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be back at the radio station. He did let me go, but that was pretty scary. I think that the thing that really helped run me out of town, though, was everybody else who worked at the station were local. And I mispronounced the word. Now, you know, Kathy, that the word H-E-I-F-E-R is pronounced heifer, in spite of its spelling.
Yes.
And I'm doing this commercial about an auction that they're having, and I said, heifer.
Uh-oh.
And as I mentioned before, this was a farm community. And when I said heifer, the station got flooded with calls. Where did you get this guy from? He's horrible. He doesn't know what he's doing. That was one of many things that happened, but I must say, in all honesty, I believe that that was the straw that broke the camel's back. The day after I said heifer, the boss called me in and told me that it was not working out, and he was letting me go. You can understand there were some mixed feelings, but I must tell you, I also felt I was being taken out of my misery. And I was so traumatized by the experiences at that radio station that I did not get back into radio until 19 years later, which was 1982.
Oh, that's sad. On a happier note, in February of 1964, you'd managed to be front row center at a major event. What was that?
Yeah. On Friday, January 24th of 1964, Kathy, I heard on the radio that the Beatles would be doing two concerts at Carnegie Hall to be held on Wednesday, February 12th, a little under 3 weeks later. And that was shortly after they were to appear on the Ed Sullivan Show. I was attending NYU in Greenwich Village, and I had some free time. So on that Friday, I went to the Carnegie Hall box office, and I said to the ticket lady, I'd like to buy two tickets to the first Beatles concert, the best seats you have. About 20 seconds later, she handed me two tickets, and as I recall, they were $11, $5.50 apiece. They were indeed the best seats, front row center. Keep in mind, Kathy, there was just this lady and me. No lines or anything. Nobody was in the area. And that's because the tickets did not officially go on sale until 3 days later, Monday, January 27th. And when they did go on sale, the lines were blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks long. But I already had my ticket because this woman sold them to me by mistake. That kind lady, bless her heart, was not supposed to be selling tickets to me or anybody else.
Oh, that's amazing.
But she did, and I was so happy. My brother Ira and I attended the first Beatles concert at Carnegie, along with 2,900 other people. And even though we were front row center, we could hardly hear them sing. But it didn't matter. To me, it was the experience of a lifetime.
Wow, how fabulous. But as exciting as it was, I understand that you have one big regret, and it has to do with a lot of money.
Well, Kathy, I regret that I did not save our ticket stubs to that concert. Today I looked online and someone was selling a ticket stub to that concert, the first one at Carnegie Hall, the one that my brother and I attended, for $9,500.
Yikes.
I could say a few other choice words, but this is a family show.
From 1965 to 1967, you had a very interesting occupation. What was that?
Being an entertainer and also admittedly being a bit starstruck, I decided to try to get a job at the Concord Hotel, which was the largest resort in the Catskills, located in Kiamisha Lake, New York. I had previously been there on a couple of occasions with my parents and had gotten to know the social director, whose name was Lee Berman, a very funny entertainer who, among other things, was well known for conducting Simon Says sessions with the guests. Well, Lee agreed to hire me, and I was on the social staff for 2 years. I was the resident social staff piano player, entertaining the guests, taking requests, etc., etc., and also participating in other activities with Lee. Harry Lorraine is a famous memory expert, and after reading one of his books on how to develop a superpower memory, I also did a memory act. I worked with several others on the social staff, including comedian Stewie Stone, who eventually became one of the major officers of the Friars Club in New York City, comedian magician Rick Sapphire, who became a well-known talent agent and manager, and Canadian singer-songwriter Mark London. I often played piano for Mark, who left the Concord in 1966, and right before he left, he told me that he planned to move to England and write a big hit song. He kept his word. He wrote the music to Sir With Love, the lyricist was Don Black, by the way, which was recorded by Lulu and became the number one hit song of the entire year of 1967. In the evening, the Concord had shows in their legendary Imperial Room, featuring many of the most famous entertainers in the business. An example of some of the more memorable ones, in no particular order, were Sammy Davis Jr., Liberace, Trini Lopez, Dinah Shore, Rodney Dangerfield, Bobby Darin, Pearl Bailey, Stiller and Mira, Alan Sherman, Bob Newhart, and on and on and on. I wasn't supposed to go backstage, but just between you and me, when I could get away with it and not get caught, I did. And I got to meet many of those acts. Big thrill for me. Except on the few times when I did get caught and was told not to do it again. But I did anyway. A couple of other exciting things I'd like to mention here. Many prize fighters trained at the Concord Hotel, and I emceed their training sessions. I got to know Joe Frazier before he became the heavyweight champion of the world. He also was a singer, and I played piano for him when he entertained the guests in the Concord's Night Owl Lounge. I remember one day when Joe invited me to jog with him, and I tried, but unfortunately, I just couldn't keep up with him. One final thing I'd like to mention, Kathy, is that every Saturday afternoon, the legendary Buster Crabb would host a swimming show for the guests, and I would MC. He was a fabulous guy, and I considered it such a joy to know this man very well.
But Ronnie, you once did something that made Buster Crabb get really mad at you.
Well, yes, that's true. I guess I got a little tired of doing the same thing each week, so I decided to surprise Buster on this particular Saturday afternoon. During his swim show, as a comedy bit, Buster would do various unusual swimming strokes, and then he would say, "Ronnie, you know what that is?" And I would say, "No, Buster, what was that?" And then he would tell me, and the audience would laugh. One of the strokes that he did was a version of the backstroke, in which he would stare at the sky and make some very strange contorted faces. He would then tell me, after I asked him, that it was the sunstroke. On this one day, he did that stroke and said, "Ronnie, you know what that is?" And I said, "That looks like the sunstroke. What is it, Buster?" And he said, "That's the sunstroke, and I'm going to get you." He was not smiling, and I know he was not happy at all. I think he would have loved to see somebody throw me into the pool. He was mad, so mad that I was afraid that I would be fired as his MC. We had a little discussion after the show. I apologized, and he told me that he forgave me, but that I was on notice never to do that again. I remained his MC, and yes, I never did that again.
I understand that there's an interesting story about how, during one of your song sessions, someone requested a song and you did not play it for her.
That was during one of my evening piano sessions in the lobby outside of the dining room. People would come up to the piano and make requests, and I would gladly play them. About 20 minutes into this one piano session, a lady walked up and said, "Could you play Strangers in the Night?" I said, "Sorry, but I just played that a few moments ago." Well, the lady could have been upset at that, but instead she hung around and seemed to enjoy the songs that I did play. And after the session was over, we started talking, and I asked her if she was with anybody. When she said no, I invited her to see the celebrity show with me in the big room that evening. And yes, that lady, whose name is Iris, and I got married about a year later. And we've been married for 48 years. Come to think of it, who knows if she would have hung around if I had played Strangers in the Night for her.
I guess you'll never know.
That's so true.
In 1968, you got into a different field.
Very different. That was the year that Iris and I got married. I left the Concord social staff late in 1967 because even though it was so much fun, I decided I needed to get a real job, a.k.a. a higher-paying job. I decided not to pursue my interest in television, motion pictures, and radio, which I had majored in, but instead to find a different line of work. Being a logical person, I decided to try to get a job as a computer programmer. AT&T offered me such a job in that field, which included them training me. I began working for them in January of 1968, and believe it or not, remained with them for about 31 years, writing hundreds of programs in COBOL and assembler language for mainframe computers. And I worked for about 10 different bosses. About half of them liked me. I absolutely love programming, Kathy, but there was one thing about the job that I did not love. For many years, I wrote programs for their billing department, and billing was very important to AT&T. With that in mind, most of the time, I had to be on call in the middle of the night in case any programs that were part of my billing environment, whether I'd written them or not, crashed. When that happened, I would be awakened from a sound sleep at 3 in the morning and would have to instantly get dressed and make the one-hour trip to my work location to immediately fix the problem. I left AT&T in 1999 and got several computer consulting jobs after that, and thankfully none of them disturbed my sleep.
How did you get the job working for Casey Kasem?
That actually came about as a result of working for AT&T. I worked in central New Jersey, and I wrote a monthly pop music column for a local AT&T publication called RRC Byline. My column was called Off the Record. One of my coworkers told me about a weekly radio show that he had just started listening to called American Top 40. It was hosted by Casey Kasem, who played a countdown of the top 40 national hits on the Billboard Hot 100. I tuned in, and I instantly loved the show. So much, in fact, that I decided to write an off-the-record column devoted to it. I called up the Watermark Company in Hollywood, which produced the show, and told them of my intention. I even asked if they could put me in touch with Casey himself. Ha 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 ha. To my utter surprise, they instantly gave me, keep in mind I was a nobody, Casey's home phone number. I called it, and Casey and I had a wonderful 15-minute conversation, and he wished me luck with my article. I wrote it, and it was published in RRC Byline. I sent it to my initial contact at Watermark, expecting to receive a thank you letter, and that would be the end of the story. Well, I never received a thank you letter. Instead, at about 9 p.m. one evening, the phone rang, and on the other end was Don Bastani, the producer of American Top 40. He told me that he and everyone at Watermark loved my article, and they then said, "How would you like to work for us as the East Coast researcher for the show?" I pinched myself to make sure it was not a dream. I accepted his offer, and I was the East Coast researcher, as well as their interviewer and writer for American Top 40 for 15 years, 1972 through 1987.
Do you remember who was the first act that you ever interviewed while working for Casey?
Yes, I sure do. It was a singer from Miami who was having her biggest hit ever. Her name was Betty Wright, and that hit was Clean Up Woman.
A clean up woman is a woman who gets all the love we girls leave behind. The reason I know
that was how it started for me back in 1972. My phone interview with Betty was the first of more than 1,000 private phone interviews that I did for Casey during the next 15 years. And by the way, these interviews were never played on the air. Neither my voice nor that of the person I was talking to was heard on the show. But I recorded most of them on reel-to-reel and cassette tape. So, Kathy, I do have plenty of wonderful memories that I can revisit whenever I choose. My job as the East Coast researcher for American Top 40 was to contact recording acts that were in the National Top 40 based on the Billboard Hot 100 and, whenever possible, interview them to gather material for Casey to use on the show. I would contact the record companies, the managers, and press agents to gain access to those acts. And what Casey did on the show and became famous for was called teases and hooks. Casey would tease a story by saying something like, "Coming up, we have a singer who wrote and directed an acclaimed documentary about prize fighting. These days, his big prize is his first hit single." About 5 minutes later, Casey would reveal the hook. He would tell the details of the story and, of course, conclude with the identity of the singer and then play the singer's record. In this case, it was Harry Chapin, who produced a documentary film about prize fighters called The Legendary Champions. And that first hit single was Taxi. It would take too long to mention even a great number of the interviews that I did, but I'll just mention a handful right here of some of my favorites with some of the biggest names. They include, in no particular order, those interviews that I did with Barry Manilow, Michael Jackson, Neil Sedaka, James Brown, Paul Anka, Olivia Newton-John, Frankie Valli, Brenda Lee, Kenny Rogers, Whitney Houston, Bobby Vinton, Lou Christie, Brooke Benton, Roy Orbison, Morris Gibb of the Bee Gees, Glenn Frey of the Eagles, Lionel Richie, Tommy James, The Righteous Brothers, and Meat Loaf, who I will mention again in a few moments. In addition to those big-name acts that I just mentioned, there were also dozens of other very talented acts who had a lesser number of hits, including many who people call one-hit wonders. I must tell you, Kathy, it was loads of fun, but also it was a lot of work with a lot of responsibility. My job during these interviews was to make sure that I came up with lots of teases and hooks for Casey to use on the show, as well as additional information about the act. After my interview was over, I would relay my information to one of the show's producers. Most of the time, it was Don Bastani who had hired me, but there was also a second producer who came aboard by the name of Nicky Wine. If I did not come up with several interesting stories based on my interview, I would feel that I had failed. Happily, though, that did not happen very often, and they did keep me around for 15 years. So I can't complain. Well, except about one thing. Michael Jackson told me about his pet rattlesnakes. He had several, and I was convinced that it was a blockbuster story. But the producer whom I relayed the story to, I won't say which one it was, did not feel it was interesting at all. And as a result, Casey never used it. Believe me, though, Kathy, that is one of my very few regrets.
I understand that Iris got a big shock one day when she received a check in the mail.
I'll say she did, and then I did when she called me at my AT&T work location and told me about it. Every couple of weeks, I'd receive a payroll check from Watermark for my services as AT40's East Coast researcher. Well, this one day, Iris called me up, very excited, and said, "You're not going to believe this. They sent you Casey's check by mistake." I don't recall what the exact amount was, but I can tell you that it was several thousand dollars. And the dollar amount was 2 digits greater than the dollar amount on my check. Well, I told her, since Casey got my check and I got his check and we each have a check, why don't we just keep what we have? Of course, I was kidding. And a couple of minutes later, I called Watermark and we straightened it out. Meaning, he got what he was supposed to get and I got what I was supposed to get.
You suggested that I mention a what's for dinner story. So, Ronnie, what's the what's for dinner story?
Well, Kathy, it's one of those stories that
really sticks out in my mind after all these years. There was a record on the chart that was the first hit single by a newcomer whose real name was Marvin Lee Adday. It was called Two Out of Three Ain't Bad. Iris received a phone call from his press agent, and on that day, when I was just ready to leave work, I called her to let her know that I was on my way home. And I said, "By the way, what's for dinner?" And she said, "Meatloaf. And after dinner, you're interviewing him."
Oh, well.
And going from the somewhat ridiculous, even though true, to the sublime, I'd like to add one more thing about my AT-40 experience. Although I usually communicated directly with the show's producers rather than with Casey, I did get to know Casey personally. The show was produced in Hollywood, and Iris and I made two trips out there and spent time with Casey and his family, and I spent time with Casey and the AT-40 staff. And on several occasions, during my tenure with the show, and up until about 3 years before Casey passed away in 2014, he and I did talk on the phone. He was a wonderful guy, and he always respected me and the job that I did. He always treated me very well, and I miss him so very much.
How did you become involved with Rubik's Cube and become the country's fastest over 30 qubits?
Rubik's Cube was a toy puzzle that swept the nation beginning in 1980. I'm sure all of my listeners are familiar with it. Anyone who needs a refresher course can simply Google it. There was an easy part and a hard part. The easy part was to scramble the cube so that the colors were all mixed up, and the hard part was to unscramble it and wind up with all the colors on each side being the same. I must admit that it was mostly kids from 12 to 18 who were really into it the most, and also were the fastest solvers. But even though I was a mere lad of 39, I was also a kid at heart. I read many books about Rubik's Cube, and using those and a home computer, I developed a system that enabled me to solve it in under 50 seconds almost every time. Ideal Toys, who marketed the cube in the United States, ran a series of 18 cubathons throughout the country in which cubists, that's the term that was used, could compete against one another and win gold, silver, and bronze medals, as well as dollar prizes. I practiced and practiced and practiced. I was totally obsessed. And in 1982, I traveled to Landover, Maryland to participate in one of the 18 cubathons. Everyone who competed against me was 18 or younger. I did the cube in 43 seconds, and by so doing, finished in second place. I lost to a 16-year-old kid named John McIntyre, who did it in 37 seconds. My prize for being the runner-up was a silver medal plus $100. Ideal Toys published the results of all 18 cubathons. I and one other person named Ed Mandel, also age 39, were the oldest people listed as cubathon medal winners. But Ed's solving time was 59 seconds, which was 16 seconds slower than my time. I was never nearly as good as the fastest kids, many of whom were doing the cube in 30 seconds or less. But at age 39, based on the 18 cubathons, I was the fastest over 30 cubist in the country.
Your interest in Rubik's Cube led to something profitable.
Yes, that's true. And I'm not talking about the $100 that I won in the cubathon, though that was nice. No, Kathy, this was something really profitable. I heard that Ideal Toys, who put out the cube, was going to run a non-competitive Rubik's Cube get-together event in Philadelphia, just for fun, which would allow cubists from the area to meet other cubists and meet people from the company. Well, I was very glad that I went. I met a gentleman named Tom Parks, who worked for Ideal Toys,
And he was amazed that a person who was as old as I was, 39 at the time, could do the cube so fast. I just happened to mention to Tom that I was the East Coast researcher for Casey Kasem in American Top 40. Tom told me that there was a board game that was expected to sweep the nation called Trivial Pursuit. And he said that Ideal Toys wanted to put out their own trivia board game devoted exclusively to pop music. And he asked me, because of my background, if I just might be interested in writing questions for that Ideal game. I told him that I sure would, and to make a long story short, I wrote most of the thousands of questions for the game, which was called the Solid Gold Music Trivia Game. For my efforts, they paid me several thousand dollars. My one disappointment is that I did not receive explicit credit in the game as a question writer, but I made sure that I did get credit nevertheless. Ha ha. Many of the questions were multiple choice, and for one of the questions, I listed Ronnie Allen as a wrong answer. So there. By the way, the Solid Gold Music Trivia Game was licensed by the popular Solid Gold TV show, starring Andy Gibb and Dionne Warwick, among others. I was told that it sold a few hundred thousand copies.
Wow.
And for the one or two listeners who may be interested, it is still available on online websites, including Amazon and eBay.
After your radio gig in 1963, how soon after did you get back into radio?
Well, after my not-so-great experience, it took 19 years for me to muster up the courage to try it again. I lived in Morrisville, Pennsylvania, still do for that matter. Right across the bridge is Trenton, New Jersey. And there was a Trenton country music AM station called WTTM. In addition to pop music, I've always been a big fan of country music. And I decided to see if maybe, just maybe, they might consider hiring me. When I met the general manager, I did not mention my previous radio gig because I felt he might just call that other guy up and that other guy would tell him what he thought of me. But I did mention what I was doing for Casey Kasem. Within a couple of weeks, I was on the air at WTTM. And up until 1990, I hosted many country music shows on the station. There were also several fabulous side effects. One of the more notable ones, in 1986, I got to MC a Johnny Cash show at the Trenton War Memorial Building and to interview him backstage. I also got to meet his wife, June Carter Cash. When WTTM dropped country and switched to a talk format in 1990, they allowed me to host a specialty show every Saturday evening called Saturday Gold, playing pop music oldies. And in that same year, a station called WDVR-FM out of Delaware Township, New Jersey, invited me to host a Saturday morning pop music oldies show, and I accepted that invitation. That show was called The Oldies Shop. After a few weeks, I also brought in a delightful 12-year-old co-host named Gretchen Parker, who was accompanied by her dad, George Parker. On the show, I affectionately referred to him as Mr. Gretchen. So in 1990, I was very busy on Saturdays, doing two oldie shows on two different stations. I must tell you, Kathy, radio was much better for me the second time around. My bosses at WTTM and WDVR treated me like royalty and allowed me total freedom. It was the absolute opposite of my first radio experience back in 1963. And by the way, I did the oldie shop for 3 years at WDVR before deciding to retire from that show only because I wanted time to do other things on the weekend.
From Hollywood, it's America's Game. A show the whole family can enjoy, filled with fun, glamour, excitement, surprises, Wheel of Fortune.
In 1993, you appeared as a contestant on Wheel of Fortune. How did you do on that show?
I finished in the top three.
Oh, that's good. Wait a minute, Ronnie. There were only three contestants.
Well, that's true, Kathy. And as I said, I finished in the top three. Okay, I finished in third place out of three contestants. But I did win some money. And here's the condensed story of my 15 minutes of being famous throughout the country. In 1992, Wheel of Fortune had a contestant search in Atlantic City, New Jersey. I went there, auditioned, and to my utter amazement, was accepted. I was told that it might be a year before I was on the show, and that turned out to be the case. My appearance on the show was on Thanksgiving Day, 1993. By the way, at the very beginning of the show, I made a fool of myself.
In what way?
After Pat Sajak said hello to me, since my wife Iris and my daughter Jen were in the audience, I decided to acknowledge them. Very simple, right? Lo and behold, I messed up big time.
From Morrisville, Pennsylvania, says right here.
That's correct.
Let's hear a little bit about your job, your family.
Well, I'm a computer programmer.
Mm-hmm.
I have my wife Jen and my daughter. No, I got that wrong. My wife Iris and my daughter Jen are in the audience, and my son Michael is at Temple University watching me make a fool of myself as I just did.
Oh, no, that's okay. If you're going to do that, you might as well get out of the way.
That's
now.
Right. It's all out of my system
before the game starts.
Too funny.
Yeah. I know two people who didn't find it too funny. I need not identify them right now. But I did get a chance to be a comedian when Pat Sajak mentioned my interest in Rubik's Cube.
I was looking at some of your interests here, and you have one that I don't hear much about anymore, the Rubik's Cube thing. You still play with
you, not too much, but I once wrote a song called Your Cat Can Do the Cube, and the record companies agreed that I had come up with an idea whose time had come and gone.
I see. Okay, well, it's nice to have you. And, you know, we're going to work on this act a little bit, and we'll be in Vegas in about a year, I figure. You and me.
The category of the first puzzle was Clue. If you solved the puzzle, you would win money for doing that, and then you could win an additional $500 for giving the correct answer to the clue. I spun the wheel first. I called out a few letters, which, happily, were in the puzzle.
$400. D? Mm-hmm, two D's. Well, sir, what now?
They accumulated $2,600. Then came my big moment, and despite everything else, nobody can ever take this away from me.
I'd like to try to solve the puzzle.
Well, go ahead.
Pudding or terrier?
Yeah, that's it.
For solving that puzzle, I won $2,600. Unfortunately, I was unable to identify what the clue, pudding or terrier, was referring to. I incorrectly guessed Boston, but the correct answer was Yorkshire. It was downhill the rest of the way. I was unable to solve any more puzzles. And as a result, I wound up in third place. But I did have the presence of mind, nervous as I was, to surprise Pat Sajak and everybody else when he came over to shake my hand and console me.
It was great fun having you.
I'm going back home to play with my Rubik's Cube.
Well, good. Have a wonderful rest of your life. $2,600 to you. We will take a break. We'll come back and put Jimmy to work in bonus land. I like this guy.
Well, Kathy, I guess in one sense you can say that I got the last laugh. And it made me feel really good that Pat said, I like this guy. I did wind up winning $2,600 by solving the pudding or terrier puzzle. And that wasn't too shabby, even though it wasn't quite as much as I had dreamed of winning.
I understand that something exciting happened the day after you appeared on the show.
The day after the show aired, I walked into a 7-Eleven store a few blocks from my house. When I went to pay for my items, the lady behind the counter, whom I had never seen before, stared at me kind of strangely for a few seconds. I said, is something wrong? And she said, no, but weren't you on TV last night, Wheel of Fortune? Needless to say, that blew my mind.
Wow, Ronnie, that is simply amazing.
I have one parting word about my Wheel experience. I've watched the show for years, and I can tell you firsthand that it's a lot easier playing the game watching in your living room than it is playing the game as an actual contestant on national TV.
You left radio for a few years, but you got back into it in 2001, I believe.
Yes, and this time my hiatus was only 8 years. I met with the program director of station WBCB AM, located in Levittown, Pennsylvania, which is only about 3 miles from my house, and which had many shows that featured oldies. I told him of my background doing private, off-the-air phone interviews for Casey Kasem, and also told him that I'd like to do occasional live radio interview shows on that station with pop music stars of the past. Well, he liked the idea, and over the next 3 years, I did a few live radio interview shows there. The first one was with two different recording stars, Janie Grant, who had a hit in 1961 called Triangle, and Diane Renee, who had a hit in 1964 called Navy Blue. I subsequently did shows with the Mermaids, who sang the 1963 hit Popsicles and Icicles, Sue Thompson, who sang the 1961 hits Sad Movies Make Me Cry and Norman, and Paul Evans, who sang the 1959 hit Seven Little Girls Sitting in the Back Seat. And finally, I did a very special show with Diane Renee, separate from the first one that I had done with her, called Diane Renee and Friends. It featured her as well as 16 of her musical friends. And Casey Kasem was nice enough to record the opening for that show.
Hi, Ronnie. This is Casey Kasem in Hollywood. I know you're doing a special today with Diane Renee, and I just wanted to call and wish you both the very best.
Ronnie, how did you get involved with the website Jersey Girls Sing?
In the year 2004, well, in that year, a listener friend of mine named Wes Smith, an oldies fan who lives in Massachusetts, and I were talking about DJ Murray the K and the Delicates, the girl trio who wrote and sang most of Murray's theme songs on his legendary Swingin' Soiree radio shows on 1010 Winds in New York City. And they were known as Murray the K's Dancing Girls. Wes told me that through a message board, he had contacted Denise Ferry, one of the Delicates. Well, he put me in touch with Denise, and I became close friends with her. Denise told me that she and her music friend, Bernadette Carroll, were planning to create a website primarily devoted to, but not limited to, pop music of the 50s and 60s. Tommy DeVito of the Four Seasons told Denise, "Since you were Jersey girls in the 50s and 60s, and since you both sang, why not call your website Jersey Girls Sing?" And so it became. Denise told me that she would like me to contribute to that website. And I told her, okay. She and Bernadette hired a webmaster, Al Kopek, who created all the initial pages. And pretty soon, the website, JerseyGirlSing.com, was a reality. It has been alive and kicking for about 12 years, during which time I also have become a webmaster for the website. I have my own Ronnie Allen Theater, which consists of several pages, and you can check it out by clicking the yellow box on the home page. As for my more than 100 radio interview shows on the website, around the time that the website was starting, I got another radio job doing live interview shows at WNJC AM in Washington Township, New Jersey. I did about 60 interviews there and recorded all those shows, and they are all in my Ronnie Allen Theater on my radio page, which is called Ronnie Remembers. I am no longer affiliated with that radio station, but I've continued to do radio interview shows exclusively for that page, which I have been recording in my home, and there's about 50 of those. By the way, the Delicates named my show Ronnie Remembers, and they wrote and recorded a theme song for me.
We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s. We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers the ballads, the rock tunes, the songs we all dance to, the girl groups and boy groups, solos and doo-wops. He talks to the stars of the stage shows and sock hops. We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
Kathy, it's been a wonderful experience talking to so many gifted people. There's more than 100 on the Ronnie Remembers page, including you, whose music I have admired for so many years. Instead of reciting a list of names, which would take a long, long time, so I won't say Kathy Linden, I will simply invite everyone to check the names out on the same page which you used to click on this interview show.
Are there any embarrassing moments you can share with us?
Well, Kathy, you obviously know about this one, doggone it. Actually, I had a few other embarrassments. I made a big mistake by calling Gene Chandler, the Duke of Earl, the Duke of Oil. And another biggie when I called Linda November, the Jingle Queen, Linda December. I'm glad she still talked to me after that faux pas. But the biggest embarrassment of all, and the one that I know that you're thinking of, Kathy, occurred when I was beginning my live radio interview show with Jimmy Rogers, the man who sang Honeycomb and so many other big hits. Yes, this was on live radio at WNJC, and I was hot to trot, and Jimmy was not quite ready to do the interview. And this is what my listeners heard.
Make me a miracle. Make me a miracle. Make me a miracle.
Good evening. I'm Ronnie Allen with Jimmy Rogers. And Jimmy, you are a walking miracle. Thank you so much for doing this show.
Hey, Ronnie.
Oh, there we go. I held my breath. Can you hear me, Jimmy?
Well, I can now. The dogs are all barking, the TV's on, and everything else. You want to start over again?
Let's start the show over, okay? I'm gonna do my introduction once again. Yeah, this is for, I know it's very sudden because we had a show right before this one. You see,
that was the problem.
So I'm going to start this over again. I'm just
Ronnie, don't start it yet till I get the
Jimmy's
dogs out of the room here.
Okay. Can I clear my throat here? Those are Jimmy's dogs, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. We have to take care of the dogs first. This is good for the latecomers, though. That's okay.
Yeah, are you there?
Okay, I'm fine. Now we're gonna pretend we didn't hear the dogs, and we're gonna start right now. We just heard "Make Me a Miracle," and what I said was, and I'm gonna say it again. This is for posterity. Good evening. I'm Ronnie Allen with Jimmy Rogers, and Jimmy, you are a walking miracle. Thank you so much for doing this show.
Well, thank you, Ronnie. I'm glad you're calling.
I didn't expect the dogs, though, at first, but that's okay.
In spite of that rather inauspicious beginning, to say the least, once we got started, our interview turned out to be fabulous. Jimmy is such an incredible individual in so many ways. And right now, I also want to mention Clay Cole, who was a legendary TV personality in New York City in the 60s. At the time I did that interview with Jimmy Rogers, Clay had a very popular website. And when he heard that interview show, dogs and all, Clay loved it so much that, without telling me he was going to do this, he devoted an entire page on his website telling the world how wonderful it was. Clay and I became dear friends, and for years, Clay promoted my interview shows like crazy. It was largely thanks to him that thousands of people have, over the past 12 years, listen to my shows that I've done for Jersey Girls Sing. Sadly, Clay passed away on December 18th, 2010. I miss him so very much.
I know you want to mention some family members. Please do.
Yeah, I better.
Yeah, right.
actually, I've already mentioned a few of them. I've been married to Iris for 48 years, and I still haven't played Strangers in the Night for her. Shame on me. I think I'll do it this evening. We have two children, Jen and Michael. Michael is married to Claire, who is our daughter-in-law. And they have two children, 10-year-old Aaron and 2-year-old Alice, our grandchildren. And they have two dogs, Oscar and Athena. They are our granddogs.
Ronnie, I have a big surprise. There's someone on the phone who wants to say hello.
Hi, Ronnie.
I know who this is. Denise Ferry, who is one of the Jersey girls. How you doing, Denise?
Oh, how are you?
I'm fine. I've enjoyed doing this interview show with Kathy. And boy, you and I, Denise, have quite a background. And we're together now after all these years.
We only met probably like around 5 years ago in person. But you knew me actually when I was a kid performing with the Delicates at the Jersey George Tucker Record Hub. You came to see me. And all these years later, we meet through our dear friend, Wes Smith. Hi, Wes. And he is the sweetest man. And he brought us together. And as a result of that, I did a couple of interviews with you, one of the Delicates interviews we hadn't done ever since we were kids. And we created this wonderful Jersey Girls Thing website. I have to say, it would be nothing without you, Ronnie, with your interviews and your beautiful pages and your beautiful tributes for all people in rock and roll. I mean, you are one in a million. It's a blessing to know you and to have you in my life. You're a very talented man, and I am very pleased to be part of this wonderful interview. I want to thank you, Kathy Linden, and thank you, Ronnie Allen.
And thank you, Denise, for those incredibly kind words.
Thank you so much, Denise. Ronnie, we're going to close the show with your unreleased recording of Your Cat Can Do the Cube. Thank you so much for allowing me to do this show with you.
And thank you, Kathy, for making this show necessary. I mean possible.
Okay. All right. You're welcome.
I have a closing statement. Would you like to hear my closing statement, Kathy?
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, I'm glad you said that. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. Though as a would-be recording star, I am a no-hit wonder. I have gotten so much enjoyment over the years doing things that I love doing so much. And in the process, meeting so many nice people in and out of the music business and bringing things up to date, Kathy, the Internet has truly made the impossible possible. And I truly feel blessed. Kathy, I wish you and yours all of life's most wonderful blessing.
I wish you and yours the same. And Ronnie, you have interviewed so many people, and you have the gift of lifting people high because you have such a kind heart. Well, let me tell you, it was your turn now to be lifted high. And we want you to know that we all love you and appreciate you, and thank you so much for who you are. And now to close the show, this record is by Ronnie Allen and the Missing Pieces. Ronnie, who are the Missing Pieces?
The Missing Pieces are myself, overdubbed, as well as Jen. And yes, she is my daughter. I got it right this time.
Here it is. Your cat can do the cube.
Your cat is not a boob.
Well, all over the country on the bookstore racks, there's a whole mess of books about cubes and cats. People love them and they hate them, but they buy them, that's the gist. They all seem to make the bestseller list. Now I got sick and tired of watching everybody else getting rich and famous, so I wrote one myself with a surefire title. And though my book ain't funny and it ain't very good, it's sure to make me money. Your cat can do the cube. That's what I've written. Your cat can do the cube. No, I ain't kidding. Don't let his talent remain forever hidden. Your cat can do the cube.
Bum, 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 bum.
Your cat can do the cube. Bum, bum, bum.
Now he won't find it easy moving pieces with his paws. He'll need some encouragement. Give him some applause. Before he moves the top to the bottom to the floor, you'll wonder why you never ever tried it before. Now his age doesn't matter, cause the time is right. Whether cat's in the cradle or is on his ninth flight, why he'll soon be as sharp as Mac the knife, and he'll meow with delight when he gets the pieces right. Your cat can do the cue, just give him the clearance. Your cat can do the cue, he just needs experience. He'll start from scratch and with a little perseverance, your cat can do the cue.
Your cat is not a boob. He can do the
hold the cube in your hand while he enjoys the treat of arranging those colors in a way that looks neat. If he accidentally knocks a piece out with his feet, put it back where it came from.
don't let him cheat.
Now if you follow my instructions, you'll be truly amazed. Why, he'll have it all done about 100 days. See, now that's not a long time, so don't shed a tear, cause it takes most humans more than a year. Your cat can do the goo. The moral of my story, your cat can do the goo. No, you won't be sorry. He'll fear like a tiger.